Good evening and welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club, and I'll be the moderator for today's program. It's my very great pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Michael Rich, President and CEO of the RAND Corporation, one of America's earliest and most prominent think tanks. Mike Rich is the president and chief executive of the corporation, which is in fact a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization that helps improve policy and decision making locally, nationally, and internationally through its research and analysis. He has been at the organization for nearly 40 years. He's helped RAND become a leading source of expertise and evidence-based ideas in an increasingly complex and polarized policymaking environment. Mr. Rich began his career at RAND as a summer intern in 1975, which I began in the same role in 1977, although I didn't make my career at the RAND Corporation as he has. He joined the organization full-time the following year as a researcher focused on U.S. national security issues. He served in a number of senior leadership positions at RAND. He was instrumental in the creation of the RAND National Defense Research Institute. It provides research and analysis to the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the Joint Staff, the Unified Commands, Navy, Marine Corps, defense agencies, and intelligence community. He's helped lead RAND's diversification into international markets, including the establishment of RAND Europe, and the RAND Qatar Policy Institute and increasing contributions to the Asia-Pacific region. Since he became president and CEO in 2011, Mr. Rich has focused on extending the impact of RAND's work, challenging the organization to extend its legacy of innovation and decision-making assistance to stay ahead of the curve on issues that matter the most. He's expanded RAND's outreach to broadly disseminate the findings of its research projects. He's promoted new and improved ways of sharing RAND's insights and making the organizations more widely accessible. Mr. Rich serves on the governing boards and advisory committees of many policy and service organizations, including the Council for Aid to Education, the International Institute for Strategic Studies, Wise and Healthy Aging, the Every Child Foundation, the Santa Monica UCLA Medical Center, an orthopedic hospital, the Dean's Advisory Council of the UCLA Samueli School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and the UCLA Foundation. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the California State Bar. He received his BA from the University of California, Berkeley, and his JD from the University of California at Los Angeles. Please join me in welcoming Michael Rich.
Well, thank you, Gloria, for that kind introduction, and thank you all for coming. I've long known about the Commonwealth Club, and it's a real privilege for me to finally be here and speak to you. And it's great to see Gloria again. It's been actually several decades, although I've kept track of her career. While Gloria was at RAND, she wrote an important report, at least one important report that I remember, called Soviet Nuclear Energy. And it was a comprehensive summary analysis of the nuclear industry of the Soviet Union, obviously a big issue at the time. And it covered everything from nuclear reactor design to international cooperative agreements and so on. And I hesitated about maybe reminding her of that because I thought maybe I would be reinforcing in your mind perhaps a stereotype that you may have about the RAND Corporation. If you're thinking careful, rigorous, authoritative research, which is what Gloria did at RAND, that's great. But if you're thinking, yep, it's the secretive Cold War think tank dedicated to smashing the Soviet Union. If you're thinking about the movie Dr. Strangelove, then I've misled you right off the bat. So I'm There was, by the way, a think tank in Dr. Strangelove. It performed, people may remember, the cost-benefit analysis of the doomsday machine, but it was the Bland Corporation. It was not us. You know, I find there's always been a bit of mystery about RAND, and so I enjoy the opportunity to talk about the organization, maybe clear some of that up. But tonight I wanted to outline a vision for how problems in America should be tackled, especially now in an era of polarization. And along the way I'm going to mention a number of different subjects: coastal flooding, terrorism, the ozone layer, the Oakland Police Department, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, not in that order, but I'll cover all of them. But let me start with some basics, just to expand a bit on what Gloria said. RAND was established to serve a very simple purpose in my mind, and that is to help ensure that the most important decisions, and by that I mean the decisions that affect the most people's lives, that involve the most public resources, in other words, the most consequential decisions, to ensure that those kinds of decisions are made with the best available evidence. And by best available evidence, I mean the best data, even when we have to collect it ourselves, the best lessons from history, the best practices from other settings, including internationally, the best methods and tools, even when we have to invent them, the best analysis, the best findings and recommendations. Now, RAND was established, like many scientific organizations, in the waning days of World War II, just after World War II, by the man who commanded the Army Air Corps during the war. And he was impressed by the tremendous innovations of made by civilian scientists and engineers who had volunteered for military service during the war, and he wanted those contributions to continue after the war into peacetime. And he called the initiative that he created Project RAND. And despite the all caps form of that name, RAND is all caps, it's actually not an acronym. It's a collapsing of the phrase research and development, or R&D. Now, RAND was designed to be completely separate from the government, entirely civilian, an independent nonprofit organization. And the design was intended to enable the researchers at RAND to deliver clear, eyed, hard-hitting findings and recommendations to senior government officials and military officers. In the early years, RAND focused exclusively on U.S. national security issues, but in the 1960s, we expanded well beyond that to tackle social and economic issues as well, health and healthcare, education, energy and the environment, criminal and civil justice, among many more. In fact, I see the man who is largely responsible for that diversification, David Lyon, here, one of my longtime friends and colleagues. So welcome to David Lyon. RAND's contributions over the years are many. I'm not going to give you a long, long list, but I'll just throw out a few before I get into my vision here. The first careful evaluation of putting a world-circling spaceship into orbit 11 years before Sputnik. The concept of packet switching, originally designed to ensure communications in the aftermath of a nuclear attack, which we were worried about, but eventually the root technology of the internet. The first comprehensive database of terrorist actions and terrorist groups and tactics. The data that led to the ban on the substances that deplete the ozone layer, the CFCs. And then the first detailed analyses of such disparate phenomena as the crushing financial burdens that led to the collapse of the Soviet Empire, the extent of psychological and cognitive injuries from modern combat, more recently, the mounting costs of dementia now and into the future. So just a small sampling, but I'm hoping it gives you some feel for the range of issues we are involved in. No partisan affiliation at RAND, no ideological orientation or leaning, no commercial entanglements. Our research and recommendations are trusted because we're nonpartisan. We're impartial. In a word, we're objective. Now, working at RAND, where we believe that the most important problems need to be tackled with the best available evidence, that is a lot more challenging today than it used to be, given how polarized the body politic and the public debate is. I once told my kids that there was a time not long ago that there were some Democrats who were more conservative than some Republicans, and some Republicans who were more liberal than some Democrats. The political parties overlapped, and they were incredulous. There is no overlap whatsoever today. Precious little common ground for solving problems. And let me share with you one telling example, at least for me, how bad this problem is. Back in 1993, President Clinton nominated an appeals court judge, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mentioned I was going to come to Ruth Bader Ginsburg for a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. She went on to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate by a vote of 96-3. 93% of the Republican senators voted in favor of her confirmation. And this wasn't an isolated case of bipartisanship, because with the exception of Clarence Thomas, a special case, as everyone knows, the five most senior members of the Supreme Court were all confirmed easily, receiving an average of only three no votes. Fast forward to 2005, just 12 years later, President George W. Bush nominated another appeals court judge, Samuel Alito. His confirmation was opposed by 91% of the Democrats. And then 4 years after that, President Clinton nominated the U.S. Solicitor General, Elena Kagan, to the court. Her confirmation opposed by 88% of the Republicans. So even Supreme Court nominations are now contested on a partisan battleground. Obviously, we've been here before as a nation. I mean, after all, we fought a bloody civil war. You don't get more polarized than that. And if you think back then, elected officials debated issues with more decorum and respect than we see displayed on cable news. Then think again. In 1856, on March 22nd, a South Carolina congressman, Preston Brooks, crossed over to the Senate. Chambers, he attacked a Massachusetts senator by the name of Charles Sumner with a cane, nearly beat him to death. Following the incident, as you might expect, Congressman Brooks resigned, to be expected, but that November he was reelected to his seat. So apparently safe districts are something else that have been around for a long time. But my point here is that one of the dangers of polarization is that objectivity goes out the window. My predecessor liked to say that today's policy debates are unfortunately usually nothing more than opinions about opinions. Day after day, prominent individuals seem proud to put the facts aside as they make their cases. For instance, there was this commentary by Republican State Senator Brandon Smith. He's the majority whip of the Kentucky State Senate. He said, quote, "I don't want to get into the debate about climate change, but I'll simply point out that I think in academia we all agree that the temperature on Mars is exactly as it is here. Nobody will dispute that. Yet there are no coal mines on Mars, there are no factories on Mars," unquote. Well, Senator Smith is correct about the coal mines and the factories, but the surface temperature of Mars is closer to minus 80 degrees Fahrenheit. And then there was the late Democratic Congressman Major Owens, I think he was from Staten Island, who had this to say on the House floor about the history of the cross-Atlantic slave trade. Quote, "There were 200 million people who died just coming across. So great was the number of people thrown overboard that it altered the ecology of the ocean," unquote. Now here's the catch. We and our policymakers can no longer afford to cast the evidence aside like that. When you look at the number, the magnitude, and the complexity of the policy challenges facing this nation, that's just a luxury that we cannot afford. The national price of turning a blind eye to analysis and the evidence it produces, I think, is just now too high. So simply put, we need a renewed emphasis on objective information and rigorous analysis. So let me give you a couple of examples, three quick examples of what can happen. What's possible, really, when we embrace and apply rigorous and objective analysis? The first thing is analysis can trump complexity, overcome complexity. The Louisiana coast and its residents are at terrible risk. You know, Hurricane Katrina was a horrendous moment in time. But this is an enduring problem in Louisiana. During the last 80 years, 2,000 square miles of coastal land, important land that protects vital economic activity, provides a natural barrier to storm surge, 2,000 square miles have been lost. That's an area just about the size of the state of Delaware, not quite. Louisiana continues to lose one football field every 45 minutes, and without action, the pace of erosion is accelerating. Now, everyone agrees the coast is in crisis, but Louisiana got into this predicament because it lacked a sensible planning process throughout the entire 20th century. It's home to entrenched political interests. It has competing constituencies, fishermen, farmers, urban residents, energy companies, environmentalists. With these diverse stakeholders and competing interests, you know, frankly, to use a common phrase, it's complicated. After Katrina, the stage was set for yet another set of classic unproductive squabbles that would result in nothing more than political horse trading, policy band-aids. But this time, though, the Louisiana authorities, working with RAND, took a different approach, one that used a systematic scientific process to give a voice to all the stakeholders. RAND created a tailor-made planning tool that quantified the different policy approaches protecting the coast. So more hard structures like levees and flood walls, rebuilt coastal marshes where the land could protect or provide an additional line of defense, new land use laws and resources for elevating homes and other structures, even options for returning some land to the sea. Now, the state couldn't afford to do them all. Some even worked at cross purposes with each other. But the planning tool enabled everybody, all those constituencies, to see the costs, the benefits, and the trade-offs of each option under many, many different scenarios. And in this way, we and mainly the authorities were able to build a consensus that led to a new master plan, the passage of a new coastal master plan, with both Democratic and Republican support, which is no mean feat in Louisiana. So the moral of this story to me is rigorous and objective analysis can trump complexity. This new package of investments in the coastal master plan will steadily reduce land loss. The coast will completely stabilize by 2040. After that, the coast will actually start rebuilding itself. Potential losses from flooding will decline along with the rebuilding. And we're currently engaged in very similar kinds of climate resilience and coastal planning efforts in Jamaica Bay, which was devastated by Superstorm Sandy in 2012, and also in Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam, which is one of the most vulnerable port cities in the world to possible changes in climate effects. Second, rigorous and objective analysis, I think, has been shown to resolve highly charged contemporary debates, even when the subject seems opaque and intractable. One of the most sensitive and divisive issues of our day is racial profiling. And about 10 years ago, a little bit more, RAND was asked to determine if the Oakland Police Department was using racial profiling in deciding which motorists to stop. On first blush, this is a very highly subjective issue, and it seems impossible to quantify. We certainly couldn't go out and ask or interview officers and ask them if they were stopping drivers because of their race. It was straightforward to count the number of stops and then calculate the distribution by race of the drivers, but then what do you compare the distribution list to know whether it's out of line? There was really nothing to compare to, no agreed comparison group. So we came up with a new method that was remarkably simple and objective. We would collect data on motorist stops during the hours around sunset on the days just before and immediately after the switch to daylight savings time. Now, you're probably wondering, as I did, what on earth is the relevance of that to racial profiling? But consider this. On days preceding and following the time change, during the period right around twilight, traffic volumes, driving patterns, other factors are constant. They don't change just because the time changes. There's only one day-to-day difference, and that's the officer's ability to see the race of the driver. That's relatively easy to do before sunset, but you'll see tonight when you're going home. It's almost impossible to do after dark. So if officers were using race as a factor, we would see more African-American drivers pulled over on days when the sun was still up. In other words, in research jargon, we now had a control against which to isolate variations. And we ran the numbers, and the data showed that the overall proportion of blacks and whites being pulled over in Oakland didn't change before and after the time change. And as a result, we concluded there was no systematic or department-wide racial profiling in motorist stops. But bias doesn't have to be systemic or pervasive to affect the way a community views law enforcement. So the data also permitted us to pinpoint specific officers whose stops didn't match the overall pattern, and those were the ones we pinpointed to the department for special training and additional monitoring. And this method was embraced by all the interested parties who were contending with each other, and as a result, so the findings and recommendations were embraced, and we've since gone on to perform similar analyses in both Cincinnati and New York City. My third and last example is, in a polarized environment, sometimes it's only rigorous objective analysis that can show that something that is politically unpopular is actually the right and the pound-wise thing to do. And consider the debate in this country about our prison system. The United States has by far the highest incarceration rate among democratic countries. The U.S. represents about 5% of the world's population, but we house 25% of the world's prisoners. The United States spends more than $60 billion a year on its penal system, mostly at the state level. So it's important to know if there are cost-effective ways to bring the prison population down without imperiling public safety. Now, each year, about 700,000 inmates are released from prisons, mainly state prisons, into society. Within 3 years, 40% of them will be rearrested and reincarcerated, either for new crimes or for violating the terms of their release. 40%. I mean, just think about that. The vast majority of these individuals are undereducated. They have spotty or non-existent job histories. That makes employment after release virtually impossible. The U.S. Departments of Education and Justice asked us to evaluate the effects and the costs of correctional education programs, which have largely been eliminated during the recent recession in the United States. And when we found that when you calculate the cost of an effective education program and the cost of reincarcerating someone for the average 3 or 4 year period that these recidivists go back to jail, the break-even requirement is about 3.5%. In other words, if you can reduce the rate of former prisoners returning to prison by 3.5%, the cost of the education program would be offset by the avoided costs of reincarceration. The evidence is really clear and compelling, at least to me. Participating in a prison education program increases the odds of getting a job by 13%. Participating in a high school GED program while in prison reduces the odds of returning to prison by 30%. And remember, this return on investment only takes into account the avoided reincarceration costs. It doesn't include even the broader social benefits of having former prisoners in the labor force and in society instead of back behind bars. Picking these kinds of investments, ones that are selected for their returns on the basis of rigorous objective analysis, it's probably what made lots of you wealthy, I would guess. But is the polarized public sector able to do the same, make those choices? I think that's the big question. So with these examples in mind, you have an idea why I believe that rigorous and objective analysis can and should be applied to all major policy challenges that we face today. Fill in the blank: immigration, defense spending, infrastructure investment, homeland security, even health care. Our analysis shows that whatever you may think of it politically, the Affordable Care Act is actually a very effective way of increasing the number of Americans with health insurance coverage. But being insured is not the same as having access to care. And having access to care isn't the same as receiving necessary and appropriate care. And it's not the same as avoiding care that's not called for or even dangerous. And although it sounds counterintuitive, investments in the healthcare treatment system may not even be the best way to improve health and well-being of families and communities. And we're hard at work on analyses in each of these areas well beyond the point where the Affordable Care Act leaves off. So I just want to make it clear in ending, I'm no Pollyanna. I know this isn't going to be easy, but I've had nearly 4 decades of experience at RAND. I've seen that rational approaches, bolstered by rigorous and objective analysis, can achieve real results, even on the most divisive, most contentious, most controversial, highly charged issues. And I know we're not alone, because more and more citizens, exasperated by endless gridlock, the polarization, supporting Rand-style problem-solving with philanthropy. So we're not giving up, and I'm looking forward to the day that we start hearing that our political leaders and government managers are too technocratic, too dispassionate, too unemotional. I think that'll be a really good place, objectively speaking. So thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to fielding questions and hearing your comments. Thank you.
Michael Rich, let's see, is this on? Yes, you can hear me. Thanks to Michael Rich, President and CEO of the Rand Corporation. And now let us launch into the questions that we have, and a few of my own too. I'd like to ask you, Rand produces many smart results. Research findings, you mentioned some in the areas of officers who do racial profiling, and importance of prison education. How does RAND pursue implementation? RAND produces many studies. They go to government agencies. They go to private entities. How do you pursue their being brought into application?
Well, I'm not surprised that you asked that question. It's actually the most important question that I think I and the other senior leaders at RAND ask ourselves, because the institution was designed to be an impact-centric institution, not a research-centric institution. The mission statement of the organization, which you read, is very clear. It has a means and an end, and research is the means. It's not the end. The end is improving people's lives by enabling decision-makers to make better decisions. And so we do not regard the publication of our research results as anything near the finish line. That's really the starting line for us. And increasingly, we've improved our ability to carry forward the research into implementation, even working side by side with decision makers.
So could you give a few examples? You do briefings, you do congressional hearings. What is the range of methods to try to implement the results?
We'll often help draft legislation to illustrate how the recommendations can be enacted into law. We'll help with program design and program evaluation. So we have a wide variety of ways, and increasingly we're using our graduate school. RAND has a large PhD program to help with capacity building so that we transfer some of the same decision-making techniques we use in our analysis so that clients, government decision-makers, can use them in carrying forward the programs and policies.
Could you describe RAND broadly in terms of how many staff, what departments, how is it structured, where is it located?
Well, on any given day, it seems like a simple question. There's some complexities. On any given day, there are nearly 2,000 people working for RAND. Most of them work full-time for RAND, maybe 1,500 to 1,600. But we have several hundred either graduate students or professors who are based at universities who do their research at RAND. We have 8 offices, mostly in the United States. Our headquarters is in Santa Monica, Southern California, where we have about 1,000 people. And we have other offices in Washington, Pittsburgh, Boston, New Orleans. And the week before last, we have 2 offices in Europe. As you mentioned, we had offices in the Middle East. And I just was in Australia 2 weeks ago to open our first office there in Canberra.
One of the audience members here today wants to know if RAND uses a standard methodology to examine issues.
No, we don't. We do have a set of core values, which equality and objectivity, which we've defined, and you can see our definition of quality and objectivity. It's on our website. But one of the things that's amazing about RAND is a wide variety of academic disciplines and professional specialties. The research staff is now over 1,000 people, and every academic discipline is represented, many professions as well. The specialty that preceded my era is multidisciplinary research, where people from different backgrounds, economists, historians, physicists, work together on a problem. So they're often using different methods and often inventing methods. So there's a long history at RAND. I know people here know a lot of these methods, dynamic programming, later linear programming, game theory, and so on, that were either invented or had important refinements made at RAND. And there are now some very advanced planning techniques and data visualization methods that we're about to hatch that I think will be very exciting for the research and the policymaking community.
Can you say anything more about that?
Well, I think people know we have an agreement with Lawrence Livermore Laboratory to combine the high-powered computing that the lab has with our policy analysis ideas, and I think that's going to enable us to do a lot more in the area of scenario development and analysis of planning options than we've ever been able to do in the past.
Another audience member wants to know, what role do you see for qualitative research and analysis, and who do you believe is doing it well?
Well, it's a huge part of what RAND does. The work at RAND is really of three varieties. There is heavily quantitative work. There's also very rigorous qualitative work, but the best analysis is analysis that combines both rigorous qualitative methods and rigorous quantitative methods. And I'm biased, obviously, but I don't think there's anyone better than RAND that does that.
So let's talk about the polarization in American politics. There are a lot of people in the state of California who've been thinking about this. There have been some efforts at reform here on the state level. And there's been in particular a change in the way that congressional districts are drawn. It's been put in the hands of a citizens commission to try to take it out of the legislature drawing the districts and drawing safe districts so that there are more competitive districts where more moderate candidates will get elected and perhaps they'll be more willing to talk with the other side and to compromise and so on. Has RAND played any role in this type of work? What do you think, are there more structural solutions and political solutions to the polarization that would make the political environment more receptive to rational decision making?
Well, Gloria, I wish I knew the answer to this question. How the districts are drawn, congressional districts, is clearly a piece of the problem and a piece of the solution. But it's only a piece, and it may not even be a large piece. The congressional districts, there's polarization in the House of Representatives, but there's also increasing polarization in the Senate. There are no districts in Senate races. So it's not just the districts. And, of course, a lot of people have pointed, including RAND analysis, to the fact that people are choosing to live with like-minded people, and so people are organizing themselves together. Some people believe that's been reinforced by the ability, the narrow casting we have in the media, so the ability to find channels of information and opinion that reinforce your own tendencies and beliefs on both sides of the political divide. So I think it's a very, very complicated challenge for us, and I don't have a single solution. I'm hoping ideas flow forward.
We have a new board member here at the Commonwealth Club, Ellen Tauscher, who used to represent Contra Costa County in the Congress, and she's working on a project nationally, just starting to work on it, to try to spread this idea of non-legislative redistricting as that one piece of it. So anyway, just a footnote.
Well, one important piece, I think, is voter education and just voter participation. We had an election in Los Angeles City. I'm not a resident of the city. I live in Santa Monica, but we had an important city election 2 weeks ago. Seven council districts, a huge, the second largest city in the country, three Board of Education seats, and the turnout was less than 9% of the registered voters. Our mayor's race 2 years ago, Eric Garcetti won, I think the turnout was 20%. So when you consider that only 70% of the eligible electorate register to vote and less than 10% are actually voting, We're having important decisions about elected officials made by a very small, very tiny fraction. That can't be good for democracy, in my view.
So a couple questions about how RAND persists and does its work over time. So the Cold War ended, and a lot of people thought that the study of the former Soviet Union was no longer very relevant. Well, guess what? Russia, Ukraine, that whole topic has come back. How does RAND ensure that it maintains the research capability over time and doesn't dismantle a whole area once policy seems to move beyond it? Because that area may come back as a concern.
There's three sources of flexible resources that we have that enable us to invest in either underappreciated or orphaned policy concerns. One is whatever income we can earn on our contracts and grants. The second is fundraising, annual donations that individuals make, individuals who believe in rigorous and objective research. And the third is the income from our endowment. And so the leadership of the institution has an obligation to do exactly what you say, Gloria, is to look beyond the immediate headlines, the current crises, and make sure we maintain a research capability to examine the most important questions, whether they're on the current agenda or not. So we were able to preserve expertise in the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, the Baltics, and so on, and those people are in strong demand, as you can imagine now.
And this is essentially the same question, but does RAND ever initiate research that may be important but with no immediate funder? I'm thinking about ways to tackle income inequality. This is an audience question.
We do. In fact, we feel it's an obligation to do that. We're often aided, by the way, by insightful donors. And I'll just give you a quick example of work that I think a bit ahead of its time, but I think is ultimately going to be very influential. And that's on the question of what is it going to take for an independent Palestinian state to be successful? Many people have studied the question of whether there should be an independent state or how do we get to independence. It's American policy now. It has been since President Bush was president that there be an independent Palestinian state. But nobody has tackled the difficult question of what is it going to take for an independent state to be successful. It's in nobody's interest for independence to occur and then have a state fail. And so that's been a strong area of emphasis for us. It's drawn on both our international expertise and health, education, job creation, all the other things we work on. And that's something that no government agency was interested in pursuing, but we were able to do it because of the generosity of donors.
Is there, again, there are several questions about whether RAND looks at income inequality, the decline of the middle class. Can you tell us anything about research across that area?
We haven't, but we have a project this year that it's a self-initiated research project that's trying to both build our capability to examine those types of questions as well as illuminate the trends in that area. So I'm hoping maybe next time I visit I'll have results from that. It's obviously an important topic, not just in the United States, but in many countries, including allies, this growing inequality.
Was RAND involved in design and analysis of Obamacare?
We were not involved in the design. We chose not to. We actually had a discussion inside in 2006. We knew healthcare was going to be a big issue in the 2008 campaign, and we faced kind of a choice. Would we create our own plan, the RAND plan? We felt we could do that, but we also thought there were going to be dozens of plans. And so instead, we built what I believe is the best micro-simulation model to be able to evaluate all the other plans. We had in mind an image that we would be the good housekeeping seal of all the healthcare proposals. The problem was what we didn't anticipate were none of the candidates gave enough detail about their plans during the campaign for us really to analyze them. So the answer is no, but we have been quite active in helping the Department of Health and Human Services implement Obamacare because there were, you know, many, many operational details that were left unspecified in the law that once enacted had to be worked out. And so, you know, I mentioned in my remarks that just being covered by insurance does not necessarily guarantee you access to care. And many of the newly insured never had access and didn't know the processes for gaining access to care. And one of the things we've worked hard on is developing material that HHS could pass out to the newly insured to aid them in getting actual care, not just coverage for care. So we've done a number of other technical things as well regarding the Act.
Congressman Paul Ryan, Republican, is looking at health care reform with a conservative perspective to replace Obamacare. How can Rand bridge this canyon of complex policy regulations?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, if we have an opportunity to evaluate other kinds of plans, we obviously will. But, you know, the health care challenge in the United States is so complex. You know, it begins, I think, with trying to shape the environment so that people's behavior is more healthy. That extends to everything from auto safety to gun safety, the way cities are laid out, the opportunities for exercise, and so on. In the United States, you can't mandate those things. It's not compatible with the kind of society we are, but yet we know that there would be big payoffs of that. So we're working on a number of things that will emphasize treatment, prevention, so that we don't have to pay the high cost of treatment. But one of the most, I think, challenging is in almost every other industry, when there's technological innovation, prices go down. Except in medical care. The more innovation it is, the more expensive it is. And recently, with the help of the Gates Foundation, we've tried to understand and illuminate the barriers to stimulating innovation in medical care that would reduce costs of care to see if we can begin the process of overcoming those barriers. I think that's going to be an important emphasis for the future as well.
For those listening on the radio and accessing the club on the internet, this is the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest today is Michael Rich, President and CEO of the RAND Corporation. How does RAND choose the topics for research?
Three different ways, from my experience. There are some projects that we're asked to do. They're commissioned by senior government officials. Sometimes they're congressionally mandated. I'd say about a third of the projects we can trace back to a request from a client, typically a senior government official. Another third are purely researcher initiated. We have to get a client, a grantor, to support it, but the idea we can trace back to a RAND idea. And then, because we have long relationships with many government agencies and philanthropic foundations, about a third of the projects result from a steady stream of conversations about policy challenges, and it's just impossible to pinpoint who was it that first had the idea for the project. It comes out of a collaborative conversation.
Tell us about some studies and reports. You mentioned a number in your talk where certainly you're proud of the results. They've produced some very interesting results. What else are you proud of when you cite what RAND has contributed to improving public policy?
Well, I think we've got a long list. In fact, when we had our 60th anniversary in 2008, we put out a book entitled 60 Ways RAND Has Made a Difference. It's on our website, and so at least 60 of some of the proudest ones. But let me maybe turn the question a little bit, Gloria, and tell you an example of something that I think could have a huge impact as we're working on this, and it has to do with a phenomenon that I didn't know much about called the summer slide. And I don't know if you or people in the audience know about this. This is the phenomenon that children who are tested, school children in the spring, generally do better than they do when they're tested in the fall, that there is some slide in achievement that occurs over the summer. Not for every child, but for many children. You can imagine the children who slide the most are often the ones that have other challenges, nutrition, family breakups, and soul poverty. It turns out that this slide is cumulative. The children begin to learn again in the fall, but they don't learn at a faster rate, so the loss is cumulative over time. And by the time children get to the ninth grade, many times the accumulation of this summer learning loss accounts for a huge fraction of the achievement gap. And we do know from a randomized control trial that we've conducted with the help of the Wallace Foundation, funding from the Wallace Foundation, that there are ways to arrest cost-effective ways and cost-effective ways to stop this slide. And doesn't necessarily mean year-round schools, doesn't necessarily mean public programs. This could be a huge, once we finish this research, presuming we're effective at disseminating it and getting school districts to adopt, this could be a huge effect on not only the achievement of children, but also the evenness of achievement across different categories of children.
You talk about dissemination. Are the reports made public? If so, how do you gain access to the information? And what types of information and reports are still considered confidential and not released?
Well, we believe strongly in both publication and wide dissemination. We will not sign a contract with any client that gives the client the right to censor or block publication. We don't publish everything. We don't publish things that don't pass our quality assurance process. We don't publish things that may not have any public value. But each year we publish almost 1,000 different titles. They're all available in full for free electronically on our website. We go back each year and add more of the volumes from the pre-electronic age. I think we have over 20,000. Of our documents available in full for free. And then we have a nominal charge if somebody wants a hard copy.
One of the most talked about and controversial RAND studies, and I apologize in advance for bringing up this old canard, was the one that concluded that alcoholics could drink in a measured way. And that's maybe a bit of fuzzing of the results. And then research sort of went back and forth, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, for many years. How did that ever come out in terms of the actual conclusions?
Yeah, you know, you've stumped me on that one. It was a bit before our time, middle 70s, I would say. I think there's probably maybe somebody in the audience who knows
there probably a couple people who could answer
that question. But what it did do, it taught me a lesson, that whole stream of work on alcohol abuse. I got involved because there was a huge problem in the Air Force in the late 1970s involving heavy use of alcohol by young and new, generally men who, young men who joined the Air Force, auto accidents, equipment failures, problems with equipment and so on. And there was a lot of concern in Congress that there was something about military service that was causing alcohol abuse. And I remembered overseeing the research that showed that there was tremendous alcohol problems, but when you adjusted demographically for the composition of the Air Force, especially the enlisted force in the Air Force, and you compared it to the civilian population, generally young men away from home for the first time, actually, it wasn't an Air Force problem, it was just a problem of that particular age group. And so we've continued to do a lot of work on substance abuse and so on, but I know the study that you're thinking of, and I don't know how that was finally resolved.
I think we can probably see David Lyon after the after the program.
Probably knows.
There are a number of questions about RAND research on particular topics. Does the RAND Corporation work in researching and consulting about landmine removal? If so, what are the details?
Very important issue. I'm just not aware of any research on that. Easy to search the website for any, but I'm not aware of any.
Can you comment on Rand's research on the rise of drug-resistant superbugs and the threat from them?
Huge. In fact, it's the subject of a Rand report. This problem of antimicrobial resistance is either a large problem or an extraordinarily large problem. This is maybe a good way of getting people to visit the website, because last year, 2014, we issued the report. It was done primarily by our staff in Europe. This is something that is of serious concern, I think, to everybody.
Talk about Rand's studies of the potential perils of autonomous vehicles. Will the benefits outweigh liabilities?
Well, this was a subject that we did invest our own resources that we were lucky enough to have from donors in trying to outline both the benefits and the potential downsides, including some of the challenges in the regulatory regime. I believe that the benefits outweigh the potential downside. I was reminded that at one time in modern economies, elevators were not autonomous. People didn't want to get into an elevator without a human operator. So I know it's daunting to think about vehicles without, although we have subways and other kinds of trams and so on, without human operators. But I think the benefits are not only in the potential for saving lives, fuel efficiency, and one that I hadn't thought of a lot is enhancing the independence of the elderly, enabling people to avoid institutionalization, which is often triggered by mobility issues. It could have huge, autonomous vehicles could have huge benefits. So I think they are coming. They're technologically, there are many sort of semi-autonomous features on vehicles today. But again, I'd point people who are interested to the RAND website, and you can see the analysis which we published.
Does the RAND Corporation study energy policy? Did it foresee the shale gas revolution, and what does it see as long-term energy policy goals for the U.S.?
Well, we actually did, and there's you can find some work from about 10 years ago that talks about the potential supply boom that shale affords. We've also looked at some of the complications from the technology to extract oil and gas, particularly fracking. There are both some health consequences, but in particular some infrastructure damage issues that are not huge in resource consequences, but there are often there are some distributional considerations that make the challenges, I think, pretty large to have a lot of growth, but we're addressing some of those issues in other research. So shale is one that we did. In terms of long-term energy, the emphasis at RAND has always been on a mix of strategies involving conservation, more efficient design of the equipment and vehicles that use the most energy. And of course, we've done quite a bit of work on the foreign policy implications of the expanded supply capabilities, including now export capabilities that the United States has.
How will big data or other new technology affect, or already does affect, RAND's work?
Well, it's a huge opportunity for us. There's always traps. More data does not necessarily mean more information or more insights. You've got to have a plan for how to use the data. We've grown our capabilities to handle very large data sets and do complicated analyses with them. And I think this is going to be particularly important for policy challenges that have many, many variables and only see the effects of policy changes over long term. So any type of natural resource policy, the effects of climate change, all the work we do on storm surge, coastal protection, recovery and planning resiliency in the face of natural disasters, all of that makes use of large data, high-powered computing. So it's an important part of policy analysis now.
This is a little bit of a challenging one. As a government or state agency, why would I engage with RAND rather than a McKinsey, Bain, or other private sector company with a specific industry expertise?
Well, many government clients come to RAND because they recognize that RAND has the industry expertise, but no commercial entanglements. So you're referring to management consulting firms that are outstanding at what they do. But RAND has no commercial relationships. We don't do any proprietary work for industry. Never have, and so sometimes there are public sector questions where the government needs an answer that is not either colored by the commercial relationships of the organization or in research, or can't be undermined by an appearance of conflict of interest.
Is RAND studying the security risks associated with the broad availability of drones?
Yes, and again, if you can see a series of publications that we just issued, I think, at the end of 2014 and into 2015, that looks primarily initially now at the offensive opportunities afforded by drones. I think people at RAND are, I think, less enamored of the transformational effects on of drones. But increasingly we'll need to shift attention, as the questioner suggests, to the defensive implications.
What's RAND's budget?
This year it will be just about $300 million of commissioned research, just a little bit under $300 million.
And the independent research, or what used to be called RAND-directed research?
Is included that it's about, I would say, 5% of the total. We'd like it to be.
How does RAND maintain objectivity as a nonprofit that accepts contributions from private sector firms and similar donors?
Well, first, we don't accept any donations that come from the defense industry. And the reason for that is our special relationship with the Pentagon often requires us to do research that affects the fortunes of defense industry firms. And so we don't want any commercial entanglements that would allow people to question the objectivity. But we believe that transparency is an important dimension of maintaining objectivity. You know, there's a famous saying by a former Supreme Court Justice Brandeis that sunlight is the best disinfectant, and we believe that to be the case when it comes to research. And so the publication, and I think people have come to know that we'll publish the research whether or not the client likes it or not, and so people know that we pretty much call the shots as we see them.
Speaking of work for the Pentagon and on national security, are you doing any research on ISIS, ISIL, that particular problem?
As you can imagine, yes, yeah, quite a bit of work on financing, on recruitment, on the danger of the foreign fighters returning to their home locations. So very difficult problem, one that I think is more serious for our European allies, at least initially, than it is for the United States. But there's not much separation anymore in the world, and so we're not far away from those problems ourselves.
So if one wanted to measure the progress or result of a RAND study,
right,
how would one do that? And the example the questioner has is success of the independent independent Palestinian state.
Well,
how would you monitor
that? Yeah, we're not successful there yet, obviously, but we have a three-tier test for judging the success of our mission performance at RAND. One is whether or not we're working on the most important problems. If we can answer yes to that, we're happy, but we're not satisfied, because the mission is to have an impact. So the second tier is, are we getting the findings and recommendations to people who can use them to make a difference? And when we can answer yes to that, we're happy but not satisfied. The real test for success at RAND is, can we point to changes in policy or practice that came at least in part from RAND research? And each year we publish the results of our evaluation. We actually do it several times a year, but once a year we come up for air, and you can see those on the website as well. But sometimes it takes a long time, and sometimes the policy recommendations just are a bit ahead of the polity's ability to adopt them. And I think the best example in my career is a piece of work we did in 1993, commissioned by the Secretary of Defense at that time, Les Aspin. And he was presented with an executive order from the president to end the discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation in the military. And he turned to RAND for an analysis of how to implement that executive order. And we produced a voluminous report. It's available on the website. It was rejected by everyone. The alternative policy was adopted, called Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But in 2010, Admiral Mullen and Secretary Gates asked RAND to take another look at that. We updated the report, and the recommendations were adopted. And so that was an example. For 17 years, we would have said we hadn't achieved our objective. But ultimately, the policy recommendations were adopted. So we don't want to give up on any of these, and we just have to be persistent.
The political environment sometimes comes back around and provides an opening for progress. Could you say a little bit about RAND's work in Qatar?
We had, I think, a great experience in Qatar. We worked in Qatar for over 10 years. You know, we're often asked to open an office in another country probably a dozen times a year. We're not a large enough organization to do that, so we've typically said, when people have asked us, let's start with a project. And the Qataris, in fact, the emir himself, not the current one, the father, former emir, asked us to do an evaluation of their K through 12, their elementary and secondary education system, which we did, and then we helped them design and help with the initial implementation of some reforms there, and I think got them off to a very good start. I think progress has been more mixed since the end of our involvement, but that led to a number of other projects on healthcare. In fact, their current system of private insurance and the way that healthcare is financed came from a RAND recommendation. So there have been some other, I think, important implementation of RAND recommendations in Qatar.
So when I arrived as a summer intern in the summer of 1977, I couldn't work in the building because I didn't have my security clearance yet. So I had to sit in a trailer in the parking lot. You may have remembered mm-hmm. that era. How much of RAND's work today is classified and goes on within the national security?
Yeah, about half of the answer this way. About half of the work is on national security matters or for agencies in the national security establishment. Of that work, I would estimate maybe half needs access to classified material in the production, in the conduct of the research. But in terms of publications, I would say less than 10% of the publications are classified. We endeavor, if we can, to have an unclassified publication and disseminate it widely.
We're getting towards the end of our conversation. One person would like to know, what's the biggest threat to RAND's existence and relevance in the short term?
Well, I think there are two, and they have to do one each with our core values. One is quality. You know, if you put, my own view is if you put a RAND report next to a report of another organization, I think people are going to know, be able to see that the RAND report is the one that is rigorous and objective. But over time, we've had to produce derivative products shorter and shorter because of the pace of decision making. So now we have research briefs and research highlights, one-pagers, tweets, and so on. And as people, you know, consume information in smaller and smaller quantities, will there still be an appetite and an appreciation for in-depth, rigorous research? The other one has to do with polarization. Is there going to be a place for an organization that isn't affiliated with any political party, doesn't have an ideological leaning, doesn't have a viewpoint going into a project only after the analysis is done? And I think an organization like RAND is more important now. Whether it's going to be appreciated, I think, is something that is a question for us. But it's not just a problem or challenge for RAND. I think it's a challenge for all Americans.
You've described a polarized political environment. Is the government in that state still receptive to RAND's research? Has that increased, decreased? And how do you push that boulder up the hill to make sure that the research does find an ear, is fed into the policy process, given this extreme polarization?
Well, there's still a strong appetite for RAND-style research. We've grown for 17 consecutive years, the largest period in our history of growth. But often, the executive branch agencies that commission the RAND research, they need legislative action to carry out the recommendations, and that's where the stumbling blocks often occur, the gridlock in the legislature. And so that remains a challenge, and I think will continue to remain a challenge until the root causes of the polarization are identified and addressed.
Our thanks to Michael Rich, President and CEO of the RAND Corporation. Thank you to our audience here in San Francisco and our audiences on radio, television, and the internet. Thank you for the work that RAND does that I had the privilege to be involved in for a couple of years, and for your long career and extremely important guidance to the organization. It's truly is a national resource.
Thank you, Gloria. Thank you.
And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.